Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our continuing series talking about the 2026 Best Picture nominees here on The Cinephiles. I am John Roker, joined as always by my fellow cinephile, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
I'm very good, and I've been cinephiling it up because I've recently watched a bunch of Oscar-nominated movies, and I have some thoughts on some of them.
Yes, and we're going to get into three of them here on the show. Just to let you know, we're going to be talking about Train Dreams, Sentimental Value, and Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein here on this particular selection. And then the last four films will come out a little bit later on in the week if you're listening to this as we're chronologically putting them out. But let's start with Train Dreams, Steve. This one starring Joel Edgerton from Clint Bentley, based on the novella Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson. This one follows Joel Edgerton as the Robert Grainier, his 80 years of his life in this movie. And it's not a spectacular life, an incredible life by cinematic standards, but it actually kind of profiles how amazing a life can be, even if it's a simple life, and the journeys you go on and the things you realize as you reflect back on your life before, as you get older. What were your thoughts on this particular movie here from, again, director Clint Bentley?
It's funny. As I said before, I really do like the slate of films nominated for Best Picture this year. And I've been thinking about why that is. And we're right at this moment, and you and I recently recorded a short about the current, you know, about the current slew of AI slop that is showing up. And it's all of this Superman fighting the Hulk and Tom Cruise fighting Brad Pitt. Right. And the thing we are talking about is the thing that really makes this year's movies work for me, which is that the thing that is missing from all that AI stuff we've been seeing is humans, is human vision, is a human filmmaker saying, this is how I see the world.
Yeah.
And I think we've gotten like lulled into an idea that that we could just replace that with a computer. Yeah. And this movie is a perfect example of why you can't do that.
Yeah.
This movie is a unique vision of a unique life presented in a unique way that I never knew that I needed to see, that it never occurred to me was a kind of movie I wanted. And I love this film. Loved it from top to bottom.
Yeah, this is, you know, for all my enjoyment of the superhero movies that you're referencing, Steve, and the tentpole films, I know you enjoy some of them as well when they're good.
Sure, of course.
There's always fun. That's always fun in that, right? But the reason we do the show, the reason we love movies, are movies just like this. These quietly simple films that are actually deceptively about more complex things, that are making a commentary about our existence, about our lives, and are performed by incredible actors like Joel Edgerton and Felicity Jones and John Deal and Kerry Condon and William H. Macy, seeing them all course through this man's 80 years of his life. And Joel Edgerton's performance is so simple and beautiful and touching here. And we see him experiencing the world and also the idea that you have to dial in at some point in order to function in the world and really walk out of the world with an understanding of what your life might have meant or might have been. And these are the kinds of films that really, I think, are the foundation of being a cinephile. And you can still love Raiders, you can still love Avengers Endgame, all those kinds of things. But I think for a lot of us who are cinephiles, these are the kinds of films where we kind of lay our groundwork in, and because it opens itself up to so much analysis and interpretation and the feeling we get that it's speaking to us directly, even though it's speaking to everyone in the theater. And I think that's the gift of a film like this. And I knew from the first trailer that this was going to be an extraordinary movie. I love this movie. I absolutely love this movie. It's in my top five of last year. And it is Joel Edgerton's performance. It's Clint Bentley's direction. And it's what we see here, as I said, a man who is like experiencing life on the outside. We get the narrator a la the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford style. That's Will Patton. And we kind of go through his life and see his experiences. And we keep waiting for that. What's the remarkable thing? Because we're so trained, like, what's the thing that's going to make this unique? And the uniqueness of it is because it wasn't a unique life. The simple life, the normal life, the everyday life is as unique as any big grandiose life or character in its own incredible way. And I think that's one of the things that I was so blown away by with the movie. I've seen it three times now because it just is a very languid movement through this man's life that I found very comforting as I watched it.
It's interesting to me that you mention movies like Raiders and Avengers Endgame and things like that, because I think about, you know, the knock on Spielberg, particularly early in his career, was he was making these popcorn movies for big audiences that weren't necessarily deep. And the thing about that is the intention was different, is that you think about, we have to stop the Nazis from getting the Lost Ark or they'll take over the world. We have to stop Thanos from destroying half of humanity and half of the universe. Like, those are big themes. And you totally understand why a whole bunch of people would be drawn to see movies like that.
Yeah.
And what this movie did for me was, it was very much like, no, this seemingly unimportant person living a life through unimportant moments where the earth doesn't hang in the balance, someone whose story is never been told, is worth telling, you know? And that is what was so great about it. I'll tell you that, and it's also because, as you mentioned, it's got a languid pace, it has a lyrical tone, and so it gives you time to contemplate, I think. And one of the things that I just contemplated in this film that it presented so powerfully is just the passage of time.
Yeah.
And the big thing that I felt in watching it was like, oh, this is really a man's story where the story is lost. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, there's this movie, but in reality, this person becomes forgotten, you know? Yeah. And then what I felt so strongly was all of the people that he meets along the way, the personalities of the loggers in those camps, what it was like traveling on those trains, what it was like after the fire, what was it like watching his world change step by step. And all of those people are people who are probably don't have movies made about them, but all of their stories are deeply human. And just being able to see that time in America, I thought was really, really powerful.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's the line at the end of the movie, you know, after he passes on, it says, as he misplaced all sense of up and down when he's in the biplane, he felt at last connected to it all. And that is what I think was a really great way to wrap up this movie in my mind, because there, you know, we get caught up in the idea that, oh, the great philosophers, the great contemplators of life, right? But really, a lot of us contemplate what life means. A lot of us wonder moments where we're really connected and feel like we're connected to the earth and the energy and the universal vibes of what's going on. And then other times we feel this kind of disconnect and where do I find my place? Where do I belong now? And we see him going through these stages, you know, talking about him from the narrator. He was like 6 or 7 years old. He has no idea who his parents were. So he had to, you know, make a living, figure these things out. He ends up becoming this logger. And then he's just kind of doing his job. He meets these weird people. He watches a racial crime with that Chinese person thrown off of the bridge, but doesn't act on it, but it haunts him because as a regular person in that moment, he was in a state of shock watching this happen so quickly and couldn't necessarily. But of course, the heroic life is the guy who jumps in and tries to stop it. But this is the real life for most people. It's like you see this and you're just shocked by it happening. And you maybe beat yourself up that you didn't do anything. And so it haunts him. But then he meets, you know, Felicity Jones's character, and that now dials him in to a whole new other existence. But he's still going off and doing the logging, and he's working with these interesting characters. You said, Steve, the William H. Macy character, which a lot of people felt should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor. So distinct and unique and interesting. And then what he loses, and then what he does with this, and then he ends up like doing a carriage or being a carriage driver and all of that, then meets Carrie Condon's character. So it is this thing where he is going through these stages of his life, but he is constantly trying to figure out life, even though he's not this great philosopher, this great talker. In his mind, through the narrator, through Joel Edgerton's actions and his face, we know that he is trying to understand what is happening through the world as he lives through it, as he becomes out of date in it, as he has to transition to multiple jobs to survive in it. And at that end, feeling finally connected to it all, he finally understands it before he passes on. And I think that's a lot of people's lives. If you're lucky that by the end you feel like, oh, I get it now, or I feel like I understood it. And I think that's what's great about the film.
I mean, none of us are given an instruction manual for life.
Yes.
And you're right. This is life. I mean, obviously this guy went through real struggles, you know, throughout his life, but like all of us feel behind the eight ball and are trying to figure out what to do and trying to figure out who to be and where to go. And you see in his plodding way, this guy, because he's not going to solve the mystery of life, this guy.
Right.
This guy's just trying to figure out what he's supposed to do. And the, I mean, the tragedy, you know, of the Felicity Jones relationship and because you just feel like, oh, they have this thing, you know?
Right. Just like when you're,
he's figured the thing out. And then, and this is what life does is like, okay, you go, okay, my life's going to be about this. And life comes up and throws you a terrible curveball. And you're like, what is my life? Like, what is this? Like, what am I supposed to do? Because, and he knew that, you know, he had to make money. And so he had to go do these jobs. But then his experience on these jobs were so filled with cruelty and pain and wacky people and interesting people and friendship and connection. And then as it goes on, it's also, he becomes even more isolated. You know, he's doing, he's now the old man on the same job and that doesn't work, you know, as well for him anymore. I really think, and it's interesting too, there's this spiritual aspect and an aspect I would say of deep, deep sadness and a bit of madness. You know, is that he, you know, and it's so interesting when the, you know, the friend comes out to visit with him and sit and talk and you could see just all this compassion for this guy, you know, who has gone through this terrible thing and understanding of who he is, you know?
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's the gift of the movie is the simplicity of life. And then all these things that course through his experience as he goes through them. And I think the direction of Clint Bentley here, Steve, we should move to that. I mean, that his, I didn't know too much about this guy as a director. And this is, I won't say that this is a masterpiece, but there is, this is really close in the way he directs this film. And no one's going like, Clint Bentley is the next best thing. And he should be, he's on Nolan's level. But there's something about his direction here that is as good as anything I've seen in the last 20 years and how he is able to take us through this story, which could easily have gotten boring, could easily have distracted you, could easily have been like, oh, let me look at my phone. There's just something about the way he directs this, the pacing of the movie, of course, the performances here that he gets out of his actors, that I just found to be so interesting, and I couldn't stop watching the movie. It's why I've come back to watch it multiple times, because there's just something about the direction that keeps keeps hooking me and taking me through the progression of this man's life. You know, I just found it to be brilliant.
I mean, there is such a sure hand. I think he's a, this is his second feature. And there's, you know, doing a slow paced movie about a dude who doesn't talk much.
Yeah.
Set in a, you know, this woodsy, you know, setting. That's not easy to pull off and have me engrossed the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, because the advantage of making the popcorn movie is someone's coming to kill you. You know what I mean?
Yes,
like, like you have to, and you're going, the whole point is to make it the most spectacular, exciting, thrilling, involving thing. And that's super hard to do too. I mean, it's really hard to pull off, but it's very different from going like, no, no, we're just going to watch this guy go to work.
Yeah.
You know, and then we're going to watch him at home and we're going to see, you know, and we're just, and now we're going to meet this person from the Forest Service and we're just going to have this conversation. I mean, that conversation is so, with Kerry Condon is so you have a feeling that something important is happening in the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, because, you know, I think I mentioned this in one of our previous reviews, is there many kinds of movies where I generally know where the movie is going to go.
Yeah.
And this is one I don't, I have no idea where it's going to go. So when he's having this conversation, I'm like, oh, my story brain is going, oh, and this is going to be a new friendship in his life. And this will lead him to do that. No. That's not where it's going to go, you know, like, and that's, again, for a, you know, relatively new director, that's tough stuff to pull off.
Yeah. I think the film allows you to analyze that conversation. Cause I mean, after that conversation, he hears his wife and he sees, and he has that moment with his child. Right. And so it's almost like Kerry Condon is telling him, you know, that the hermit thing in the woods is important as anyone. Like she's almost saying to him, like, your life is important. Whether you're this big person on the stage or this person hiding out in the woods, there is matter to your life. And it's almost like she's offering him some closure from this pain. So the fact that he sees, you know, his wife and his child and has that experience and then, you know, wakes up as a dream. Like, it's almost like a closure type of thing where he's moving past it, because she talked about losing her husband from that long illness. So there is almost a shared pain, right? And so there's no therapist sitting down. Some people don't do that. Some people don't see that, can't afford it, or don't want to go that route. But it's in conversations with other people who have experienced pain that they find a nugget of wisdom or a way to put their loss in context or move past it, because there's a bit of healing that goes on in sharing, right? And I think for the whole film, he's not actively trying, but he is contemplating connection to things around him. And I think that conversation, you could interpret it as a way of giving him closure from the movie. You know?
I think those are great points. And it's funny that, you know, you talking about that scene in terms of that his life matters, that it has meaning, mm-hmm. that it's just as important as any other life, kind of relates in a weird way to the Avengers and Indiana Jones, which is this movie is saying this lumber carriage driver guy living up in the woods in Idaho is just as important as Captain America and Indiana Jones. His story, his life has just as much meaning, has just as much power to it. And the thing I was thinking about too, you know, we live in a world where we're just constantly bombarded with ideas and stuff and things going on. And so, you know, you can't help but seeing people throwing out quote unquote solutions to whatever your problems are. And whether or not those are actually good solutions is an entirely different topic. But like with this character, he has he's not watching TV. There's no social media. You don't see him reading the newspaper. This guy is alone with his thoughts, trying to figure out how to exist in the world, and has no guides. So when he has this conversation, the conversations he has with William H. Macy, you know, with one at the end, with this friend, you know, all of these conversations, that's it. You know, these are the moments where he learns, like particularly I think with the William H. Macy character, like that's a person who teaches him about what life is, you know, like, and he learns those little tiny lessons, and then he crunches on them in his mind, you feel, day after day after year after year, trying to think his way through or be his way through this problem of who am I supposed to be in the world, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think a guy like this in a different situation could have become a great thinker through universities, if he had found a way into some teacher guiding him into something, and then boom, he's out here like contemplating and thinking about and writing these kinds of things, and could have been this. But this is the life that he was handed and did and lived. But there's, as you said, a lot that he contemplates and considers and chews over and doesn't run away from it. And even the scene where you see, you know, near the beginning where they're nailing the boots to the tree as a way of symbolizing that you actually existed, it's transitory. So the whole film is kind of just showing you that everything is transitory. And the only life you can live is your own. And, you know, seeking connection is a way of dialing into what life is all about. Can you do it? Can you handle the after effects if the connection goes away in the way that it does in the movie? So there's so much to consider as you're watching the film, as you're watching. And, you know, this is where Joel Edgerton is the best. The quiet, simplistic performances, the contemplative performances is where I enjoy Joel Edgerton the most. And he's such a great leader for this. And I was upset that he wasn't nominated for Best Actor, because I think he's incredible in this film. You know?
I totally agree.
Well, this film is nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Original Sound. I don't know that anyone thinks they have a chance to win any of these, except maybe cinematography for Adolfo Veloso, but I don't know. What's your feelings on these nominations before we move on from this movie, and what chances do you think it has?
Yeah, that's probably what I think. I probably think it has very little chance for any of these things. You know, it's funny. I really like this year of films. In another year, I think cinematography definitely is one. Adapted screenplay is another one that's sort of interesting. But when you have huge films like Sinners and One Battle After Another, it's going to be real tough for this movie to compete with those, you know?
Yeah. Hey, everyone, this is John from The Cinephiles here to talk to you about Quince. You know, this time of year always makes me rethink what I have in my closet, and I'm trying to keep fewer things, but better ones, pieces that are well-made and easy to wear all the time. And that's why I keep coming back to Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense. Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials like 100% European linen and their insanely soft flow-knit activewear fabric. Their men's linen pants and shirts are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, basically the perfect layer for spring. And their flow-knit activewear, moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. I recently made a purchase of the flow-knit hoodie, and I just couldn't believe how lightweight and breathable and soft and comfortable it felt. And it's true. I literally didn't realize I was wearing it all day until I lay down on my couch about 8 o'clock and realized I still had it on. That's how amazing these products from Quince really are. And the best part is that their prices are 50 to 60% less than similar brands. How? Well, they work directly with ethical factories and they cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for quality, not brand markup. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/cinephiles for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/cinephiles for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cinephiles. Tell them John and Steve sent you. All right, well, let's move on to another film that's also about life, Steve, in a different way, a much more modern take here. And this is a Norwegian film here from director Joachim Trier. He co-wrote it with Esko Vaught. It is Sentimental Value. It follows sisters Nora, who is played by Renata Rensvi, and Agnes, Inga Ibb's daughter Lilias, in their reunion with their estranged father Gustav, who is a great filmmaker, but on the tail end of his career, played incredibly by Stellan Skarsgård, as he has written a new movie that is very much about his daughter. And we have Elle Fanning coming in as an American actress who is going to play the part after his daughter, who is an actress now, that's Nora, turns it down. So, and we explore the relationships and the damage and the heartbreak and issues between them, and we go all the way back to multiple decades to grandmothers and things of this nature, and this all set in this one, mostly set in this one house that has passed on from generation to generation. So your thoughts on this movie, Steve, and your feelings on it?
They're movies you start out. I really believe that the openings of movies and the first many shots of a movie do a tremendous amount to make you know how you're going to feel going on. And the opening of this movie is we're in that house. To me, was I got to relax in my chair because you go like, oh, this filmmaker knows what they're doing. Like they have a plan. They understand. The tone of the way it begins in that stuff in the house was so powerful. And then again, it's like I didn't know exactly where we were going to go and how it was going to be. I'll tell you one thing that's funny. We recently had Shannon McClung on and talked about Wonder Man, the TV show. Yeah. And one of the things we discussed is that the opening of episode one of Wonder Man, where an actor is doing some stuff, was unbelievably stressful and difficult to watch. And the opening of this, after the stuff in the house where she's backstage having a panic attack going on, it was so rough to watch. It was so stressful. And what it does is it immediately, I mean, just the image at the very beginning, there's an image of a crack going through the house. Yeah. Yeah. And then we go to this woman who's having this panic attack before going on stage. And it's like, oh, this is going to be a movie about trauma, about the hidden things that haven't been dealt with, that sit underneath. And one of the things that I think is so successful at is just how fucking hard it is to talk to someone that you love who has hurt you, or someone you have deep, there's a past there, and you can see with her and Stellan Skarsgård is like, it's so hard to get someone to hear you, to get someone to understand, to get someone to connect with what your experience is. And I think this movie does a beautiful job exploring that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating film for me, because I found myself as an audience member judging both Nora and Gustav. I actually thought the daughter, who is the most put upon, Agnes. Agnes is the character that I most connected with in the movie. The idea of her navigating these two mercurial people in her life and having love for both of them, because both of them were essential to certain sections of her life, right? When growing up, the dad, and then when the dad left and the issues with the mom, the sister comes in, as she tells her near the end of the movie, tells Nora, how I know you don't know that you can care for people, but you took care of me when everything fell apart, when mom was down, when all this went down, you took care of me, you know? And so there's just something about her journey through the movie that I found myself more interested in. But the other two characters, I had to really have a conversation with myself because it's challenging. They're challenging people to care about because I found myself judging them. And this is part of getting older for me as a human being. I find that some of these characters, and I'm sure you've had the experience, Steve, as well. Like you find yourself judging these characters rather than going like, you know, you've got to create space and grace to understand these characters, which is what the movie is essentially trying to tell you, is that you can be caught in the cycle of trauma. You can be caught in the anger and the frustration and all of this kind of stuff. But until you find your way to process it, to put it in its context, to create understanding, you won't be able to move on with your life. You'll be haunted by it constantly. And I think that's what you explore in their relationship. And even by the end, there's no kind of like, I'm sorry, Dad, I'm sorry, Grace, and all that, Anna, there's none of that. There's just this long look between them after a scene is shot where it's kind of an understanding of both of them. They don't need to say anything. Me putting you in this movie tells you how much I love you. Me committing to doing this movie tells you how much I love you. And that's what we're doing. And that's how we're working on it. And there's no big grandiose Hollywood come together moment. It is much more subtle, which I think is how it is for most people, Steve. I think we see what we see in the movies, but most people, sometimes it's an unspoken thing, which I thought was a really powerful way to do it by the end of the movie, you know?
I think those are great points. And what you made me think of is what's interesting. We know that there is trauma in their past. We know that their marriage, you know, that dad's marriage with mom split up and that he went off to make films and they felt somewhat abandoned by him.
Yeah.
We actually get very few details. Like this kind of movie, when you're going like, oh, we're going to deal with childhood trauma. Well, you're going to see that trauma and the trauma is going to be pretty traumatic. And what this is what you made me think of, and I'll try to see if I can figure out how to say it the right way, but I'm sure you and I both had long-term conflicts with various people that we've shared with each other. And when you have these conflicts, particularly with family members or people that are friends of a long time, you develop a list of stuff.
Right.
This is this thing. And for the most part, most of that stuff doesn't sound like anything. Because it's all little things that are part of this greater pattern. And and I'm sure I've certainly had this experience where I started to list the stuff and then it all just started to sound so petty, you know? But even I knew this was super important, but I like when you said it, and I think what this movie does that so we the it not having that big cathartic moment where they express everything is, you know what? It wasn't the individual stuff. It's not the little, it's bigger, it's things that you actually can't really express. You know what I mean? Like there's moments where, there's the great moment where they're talking about the kid and the kid had said, I see you. You know, they tell that story. And then Nora has sort of a panic attack. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't explain, and they never go like, why did those particular words get you in that particular way? But they did. You know, and then we're left as the audience to sort of contemplate and fill in kind of what that means. Yeah. And it's the same with the conclusion, you know, we know that they get to a place at the end. Again, it's a spoiler alert, sorry, but they get to a place in the end where they find some simpatico.
Yeah.
But we don't actually see the mechanism by which that happens exactly. Right. You know, like that isn't what it is. By the way, the other thing that really struck me watching this movie, and it related a lot to Hamnet, which is Hamnet in its way is showing the healing power of art. Yeah. And this movie in its way is showing to some degree the healing power of art. And I think the distinction is that Hamnet actually isn't about the artist. It isn't really about Shakespeare and his need to create that art. This is about the artist. And what is going on is like art is these characters' way of dealing with their trauma. Yeah. It's their way of expressing the things that actually they can't express that well in words. They are driven to do art in order to deal with the pain. And it's funny too, because we just talked about Train Dreams. And there's like, this is how is this person moving through their life? And this is how they choose it. And here's another movie. This is how these people are getting through the pain and difficulty of life.
Well, that's the thing. When you finish watching the movie, you go like, well, goddamn, they're essentially flip coins of this. There's flip sides of the same coin, both Gustav and Nora, because they're both artists and they're both driven by this thing that you can't really explain or characterize or quantify that drives them to create the work, right? Her panic attack, panic attacks, you can say are correlative to his drunken nights when he calls and leaves messages. That's how he deals with his trauma. Her trauma is through panic attacks. It is through that. She lives a life where she sleeps with a married man who's she's in love with. She has these panic attacks. She had a suicide attempt. Those are all driven by her desire to stay in the anger of the unresolved feelings of trauma. And this whole thing. So in a way, the film is almost making a commentary on like how you damage yourself if you don't try to seek understanding and closure and some kind of way to navigate your life where you let those feelings go, let the hate go, let the pain go, because all you're doing is hurting yourself. Gustav in the same situation, he's damaged his relationships with his daughters. So much so that Agnes, who has never, I think from what we hear in the movies, never stood up to him, takes him to task about wanting to use her son in his movie. That's a pretty emotional scene for Agnes's character, which I think makes it more powerful than the passive aggressive snipes that Nora and Gustav make to each other whenever they're in the same room with each other, because they can barely stand to be in the same room with each other. And you see that that's how Agnes has come to this place of understanding both of them and choosing to see the positive about them as people rather than staying in the pain or hurt that they've caused her through her life. And so I think there's just this commentary about it, so that by the end, Gustav, when Rachel walks off the film, when Elf ends, like, he is devastated by that, because I think he realizes, like, I tried to make this thing work a certain way and it's not, and I don't have the power to do it like it because I need her. I need her to be the lead of this movie. I need my daughter to be the lead of this movie. This is how it has to work. And so it's this, as you said, the healing power of art, but also why creatives turn to art sometimes is also because they're navigating their own pain through the work, through the creativity. And it's a form of therapy at times if it's done correctly. And so you see that with both of them, I think, throughout the whole movie, you know?
First of all, as far as the Agnes character, man, I feel it because I've been Agnes many times. I've been the more like calm person around people that had big, strong emotional arcs. And and you're just sitting there going like, how do I keep this together? How do I make this just a little bit more okay? And of course, you can't solve other people's problems for them. They have to find the way themselves. Right. I think Nora's relationship with the married actor is fascinating. Mm. And you have that great scene with the two of them in bed.
Yeah.
And it's so much about her. She is aware that she pushes intimacy away. And her feeling it's a good thing that he's married, because that makes her, it makes it impossible for the relationship to go to the next level. And that keeps her safer. And then he says, I'm getting a divorce.
Right.
And she has this romantic moment, but he's not going to be there with her. And her aloneness after that moment is so painful. And it totally, to me, parallels things with Gustav that we see multiple times in the movie, where you see him observing the world, him having lots of feelings and not really having anyone to express them to. Yeah. You know, he doesn't have anyone to share with. And so he's isolated, alone. I think Elle Fanning's really good in the movie. It all is a bit weird to be with her in there, but she is good. And I particularly love Gustav's sort of seduction of her when they go to the beach and all of that. And you see, you see what's magical about Gustav. And here's the thought that occurred to me. Did you watch the recent Martin Scorsese documentary that was HBO or?
Not yet. No, it's on my list of things to watch for sure. But yeah,
it's good. It's good. But here's a quick spoiler alert, is they interview his kids and and they kind of talk about, well, it was great going to the set because that's where we saw Dad alive.
Yeah.
That's where he lived. And that and it was painful to hear them talk this way, which is that all of this glowing, the sun of energy, you know, like the power of charisma and all this stuff that flowed out when he was on the set, that's not the dad that they knew, you know? Yeah. And right. I found that to be a very painful kind of thing. And that's what I saw with Gustav, you know?
Right. And Agnes calls him out on that, right? With when she says, like, he's like, this was a great time. We worked on that film together, the World War II film that we see in the film that affected Rachel so much. We see that in his mind, that was a great father-daughter moment.
Right.
Because it happened on his terms and at his amount that he could handle it. But then he moved on to the next film and was in love with those actors playing those roles. And her is like, you're my father. When you left after the move, like you didn't care for me in the same way after the movie as you did while I was on the set. And so there is don't you understand this break, this way that you can do this thing, right? That is really fascinating. And we see Nora do the same thing to her when Nora starts ignoring her calls. When she says to Agnes, says to her, like, you know, when you had a suicide attempt once, if you ignore my calls, you know what that does to me. Like, why aren't you thinking about me? And Nora the whole time has been trying to take down her father for not being considerate to them. But here she is not being considerate to her sister. So there's the similarities in their approaches to these things in their lives. And there's that, which I thought was a little bit of a artistic embellish, a little too much on the nose when we're seeing their faces blending into each other. I was like, you don't need to show off. We get it. But if you want to hang the lantern on it, fine. We get it that they're all just kind of caught up looking for the mirror versions of each other. But like, that is what is happening here. And I kind of love that as it goes along. And I do think the Rachel thing is supposed to feel out of place, right? Because it's almost like a meta thing that she is out of place in this movie when you're watching Elle Fanning in this movie, because the character's out of place playing the character of Nora in that film for Gustav. And so there is that element of it. And I feel like Elle is like, if we can say this and quantify it, like the worst part of the movie in terms of acting, but not that she's a bad actress. It's just everyone else is given so much more to do, you know?
I think the thing with that Agnes moment where she's not returning, where Nora's not returning her calls and all the little moments like the ICU moment where you watch Agnes watching Nora.
Yeah.
And you have this person that's gone to obviously a really dark place in the past. And you never stop having that worry. You know, and the thing that I think is, I totally believe that people deserve grace for their childhood trauma, for psychological issues, for whatever struggles they're going through. But there is also a weird thing where people, as grownups, will blame their parenting and their trauma for their bad behavior as grownups. And there's a certain part where I'm like, fair. That's real. And I have sympathy for that. But now you're spreading around your own trauma. This is the thing is that at a certain point you're the adult here now, you know, and those things matter. And what's so interesting, there was the moment where I think the guy she's having an affair with, they start talking about therapy and, you know, I mean, she has major panic attacks. I mean, she like, it is a big deal. And there's this moment where she's like, well, he says I should see a therapist. It's as if that's the most ridiculous thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, like it was so crazy to me where it's like, no, you're suffering in a serious way. It's not changing. Maybe give that therapy thing a shot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, for their own process, I guess therapy is not an option. So it becomes that moment. Therapy, in a way, happens in that moment where Agnes comes to confront Nora after Nora's called in sick to not, even though she's not sick, it's because Gustav has essentially shaken her confidence with this idea, like, if you don't let go of your anger, you're never going to be this great artist, which infuriates her, because the last thing you want to hear advice from is the person who has hurt you and have their advice be right. But yet, you know, clearly she knew in the back of her mind he was right, which is what fucked her up even more. And so Nora going to see her and talk to her and say, you know, like, I want you to read this section of the script, which is the section that Rachel had acted earlier in the film. And I want you to understand, like, in essence, he is apologizing for his treatment of you through the film, through the character that he's written here that's essentially based on you. And talking about his trauma from his past with his mother, Gustav's mother, who was involved in resistance, killed at 7 years old by the Nazis, that kind of stuff. he is essentially apologizing for the trauma that he's transferred onto her and how he treated her. And I don't think he feels compelled with Agnes because Agnes has always probably forgiven him. But Nora is the one who has been the most angry at him. And so this is what inspires him to write this script. And so it's in the reading of the script that the walls, the dam breaks a little bit. The walls break down and there is a sense of understanding. Even when she talks about the suicide attempt, Agnes says, it's almost like he was there. And then she says, he wasn't, but it's almost like he was there if you read the script. And so it's probably because Gustav has probably tried to kill himself a number of times as well from his own trauma. So there's a sense of connectiveness to, or similarity in the connectiveness of their trauma that they share and that led to possible suicide attempts by both in that way. You know, so it's a powerful scene, what it leads to really well in the film.
I mean, there's a way, you know, part of why you do art is to express things that you can't express any other way. And it's funny. I think people often make the mistake of when they read something that might be somewhat autobiographical or they go, well, this must be you. This must be truth, as if this is a one-to-one thing. Right. At least for me, it's never a one-to-one thing. But frequently there are emotions coming out of characters that are, I mean, they're my emotions. They have to come from me. And so, like, that is definitely how I deal with the things that I'm feeling and things that are hard to express and things that absolutely comes out in my writing.
Yeah. I think it's I do have to say that I think there are some moments that are a little too pat in how they work in the movie and how the pieces fit together a little bit by the end. Little slight convenience to it, which kind of didn't have me have this massive effect afterwards where I was like, oh wow, this is an incredible film. I was very, you know, impressed by the movie, but I wasn't necessarily like, whoa, this is giving me a lot to think about type of movie. And maybe for some people listening to us, it was that for them. It just wasn't 100% for me, but I did thoroughly enjoy it. And I loved the performances and I loved a lot of what they were saying about, the non-cliche way of dealing with trauma and resolving that trauma within this particular context of this family, you know, and even the house. I wanted to ask you about that before we wrap up. Steve, I don't have that experience. Like we've lived in the same house since 1970, or my parents have since 1979. My mom still has that house. Wow. I never stay at that house anymore because it holds too many horrible memories for me for a number of reasons. And what's going on there, I just never stay anymore at the house. It's been 10, 15 years since I've stayed at the house. But I know for you, you've got that element of like, you know, been in one place, multi-generational type of stuff. So was there the symbolism of the house, was that something that appealed to you as you were watching the movie, how it passed on from generation to generation? 100%. And then how he sells it to make the movie. Sorry.
Yeah. Having mortgaged my house to make a movie, that rings true too. Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's funny. My parents moved into the house that they're in, I think, in 1975. So, or my mom is. My dad is obviously no longer there.
Right.
I have the opposite experience. My mom's house is I love staying there. So that house is such a special place. It's a beautiful house. So yeah, I do. And I think, you know, like I think of my grandmother's apartment on Clay Street as that kind of a place. Like they're places where they're just special. You know, they've been in the family a long time and they take on significance. I also think, by the way, the design of that house, like every inch of interior, exterior, it was a personality. It was a place. It wasn't just some, you know, boxed house. This was like this place in Norway, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a description of this kind of architecture for the house that I want to see if I can find real quick, because I've never heard or known about this kind of architecture. Okay. It's Norwegian architectural idiom called dragastil, which is dragon style. That's what this wood structure is, with steep gables. And it's apparently a striking example of a turn of a 20th century Norwegian architectural idiom. It's best described as Viking Victorian. So, yeah.
Totally. I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the direction here as we wrap up this conversation on Sentimental Value? Your thoughts on Joachim Trier's direction, the cinematography from Kaster Tuksen, even the music, I thought, from Hanya Rani, that I thought worked really well in the film.
I think it's beautifully shot. It looks gorgeous. I think it's really well directed. I mean, it's, you know, it's funny. Like, this is not my favorite movie on the list. It's right. And that doesn't mean I didn't think it was a really good movie. I thought it was very well made. It was emotional. Yeah. It held my interest. It's just there are other films that I'm just way more drawn to than this one. You know,
yeah, this is the second film I've seen of his, because I saw The Worst Person in the World a few years ago, which also starred Renetta Rensby. And I want to go back and see his other films. People talk about Reprise. He also did that Oslo August 31st film, which I think is about isn't it about the terrorist attack? I thought it might be, or not, something else, I guess. But I kind of want to take a look at these films and see about Joachim Trier a little bit more, which I don't always find myself drawn to watch more of a director's films necessarily, but this one certainly put the hook in me, at least for that. So, all right, Steve, Sentimental Value is nominated for 8 Academy Awards here. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress for Renetta Rensby, Best Supporting Actor for Stellan Skarsgård, Elle Fanning, and Inga, Ib's daughter Lilias, were both nominated for Best Supporting Actress, Best Original Screenplay, Best International Feature Film, and Best Film Editing for Olivier Bouguet-Coutte. So your thoughts on what it has a chance to win? Where am I getting anything? Your thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, I think having two supporting actress nominees for the same movie, just that tends to cancel each other out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because people who love the film are going to vote for one or the other. Although I think they're both great in the film. Elle Fanning, as you said, feels appropriately out of place.
Yeah.
The one that seems most likely to win is the international feature film. That one seems, as far as the other ones, it's such a hard year. Mm. So I kind of go, well, like, it's not going to win Best Director. I don't think it will win. You know, Stellan Skarsgård, he's great. He's great in the film, but there are more spectacular supporting actors, you know, with Sean Penn and Delroy Lindo. I don't see really a chance for that there. Best Original Screenplay, it is a good screenplay, but then you've got Sinners, you know, and so it's like, and other films as well that are really good. So yeah, I'm not sure what it would get here.
Yeah, for me, I would agree with you. The way I look at it and see where it's at, I think picture, no way. Director, I don't think so. Actress, no way with Jesse. That's pretty much a given. Supporting actor is where the possibility lies, but I'm with you. I don't think Stellan did anything that grandiose in this movie to put him ahead of everyone else. I think he won one of the awards recently. I don't know if it was Critics' Choice or one of the awards he won. And I don't understand. I really would not have nominated Elle in the movie.
No.
She has a couple of really good moments, like the scene when she's reading from the script and has that emotional moment with the actress who's playing her mother. I thought that was a really nice moment. And when she's coming to remove herself from the movie, I think that's a really great scene as well. But there's not much there that I found merited a nomination. I love Elle, but I just was surprised by that one. Best Original, no. Best International Feature, I agree with you. Best International Feature, and maybe even editing. I don't know how they're going to look at editing. Because, I mean, we have those multiple black, fade to blacks throughout the movie. Is that an element of how that happens through the movie? Is the editing going back and forth in time? Is that a much more effective thing that could get an Oscar? I don't know. But yeah, international feature is probably where it's at for sure.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the editing ones, every one of them has super interesting editing. F1, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, and Sinners, they're all super interesting in terms of the way those films are cut. So I just don't see that this, you know, again, I'm going to say it for the 900th time. I'm the worst at predicting things, so I wouldn't make any bets based on what I'm saying, but that's how I see it.
All right, well, there, that's our conversation on Sentimental Value. Let's move to our last film in this particular section of the Best Picture Nominees Series conversation, and that is Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, based on Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus by Mary Shelley, who is currently a character in the Bride movie that is out in theaters right now as we're recording this, starring Jesse Buckley, who we spoke about in our last conversation on Hamnet. So, Steve, I don't have to tell you the Frankenstein story. Everybody knows the Frankenstein story. This is told in a uniquely interesting way. Guillermo del Toro, probably, in my opinion, the most artistic film he's ever delivered here. And I love the performances from Oscar Isaac, Jacob Elordi, and Christoph Waltz. A little bit less so with Mia Goth. What are your thoughts overall on this movie and feelings on this one?
I might disappoint a whole bunch of people. This movie is the one I am most mixed on. Yeah. On the one hand, in terms of its visuals, production design, costume, makeup, cinematography, it is stunning. Like every second of this movie is absolutely stunning and filled with all of the Guillermo del Toro goodness that you would expect.
Yeah.
What my feelings about this, in a weird way, really reflect my feelings of the book, which is maybe a sign of how well done this is, which is, I mean, it's an odd book. And the thing about reading that book is that it's really all about the creature. When you get to the creature's story, I am 100% involved in the book. And that is how I felt about this movie. The first 40 minutes or so, despite being well acted and well shot, and I just don't like Victor Frankenstein. Yeah. Like, he's just a jerk. And it's not that Oscar Isaac's performance is bad. I think his performance is good. I just did not care throughout the first 40 minutes of the movie until the creature shows up. And once we get to the creature's story, I was 100% in. That's what I mean by I'm mixed. Like, I just can't say I love the whole movie. I can say I love the creature and the second half of the movie, definitely.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we are going to disagree on this film, I guess, because I loved it from the first moment on. I thought Oscar Isaac was great as Victor Frankenstein. I found myself connecting with that character in a way that I'd never connected with him before in previous iterations, whether it's the old Boris Karloff film or the Kenneth Branagh movie. I don't know if there's ever been other, I know there's tons of
yeah,
there's been tons of other versions, but maybe Gene Wilder, I've loved what Oscar Isaac did. I thought this was really interesting. A man who is driven by his hubris, his arrogance, his conceitedness. We're seeing Timothée Chalamet in real time kind of possibly be blown apart for his arrogance and his hubris right now. So there's an essence. There is this belief in his talent. He's got this cockiness within him, and he's willing to go to the past what people would say is the correct place to go in order to achieve what he wants to achieve. And seeing that play out in the movie and the ramifications of that point of view, of that drive, of that ambition, of those violations of the human law, I think come to bear in their relationship. But just like our film, Sentimental Value, we just talked about, there is a sense of a father-son dynamic, a father-child dynamic here that has to be resolved by the end. And both of them have to give grace to each other after essentially terrorizing each other for a majority of the back half of the movie, that I think is so powerful. In like, I cried at the end when they have their
confrontation.
Then closure in the ship. Like, I was like, oh my God. Like, I'd never seen that in a Frankenstein movie. So for me, there was some real power in that. I think my issues come with, like, I think Maya Goth's character is severely underwritten. I think his brother is severely underwritten in the movie as well. So those impacts of their characters doesn't carry as much weight for me, but I love what Oscar did. I love what Christoph Waltz does. Such a great, he's becoming such a great character actor to come in and deliver powerful stuff and then have things happen to him. And I thought Jacob Elordi was exceptional as the monster. I said this in my out of theater reaction when I walked out, like, he should be nominated for best supporting actor. And I was not surprised that he was. It's just, to me, it is one of Guillermo del Toro's best films that he's ever done, even better than Shape of Water for me, because there's something about connecting to the grandiose guy who crosses the lines and we see the results of what happens to him. And the pathos of the monster comes through so powerfully as well throughout the whole movie.
First of all, 100% agree about Jacob Elordi. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I mean. It's like the minute he shows up on screen, I was 100% in.
Yeah.
Totally involved. The design of the creature is incredible. Yeah. Incredible. The color control, the way it contrasts with when he's in that basement, the withholding of red and having it just be with Maya or with other places, like all of that stuff is beautifully done. And I mean, the story of the creature, that kind of a story, is one I will always be drawn to, whether it's, whether it's Frankenstein or whether it's Data in Star Trek, I don't fit into the world and I'm trying to figure out how he fits. And it's funny too, I can remember in reading the book, the whole sequence of the monster and the family and him hiding out and secretly trying to help them and then creating the relationship and then being driven away. That's all in the book. And yeah. That's always been the most moving and terribly painful part of the whole story. And I think there have been various kind of versions of this, whether it's Gene Hackman in Young Frankenstein and, you know, things like that. This is by far the most successful. You become just so sympathetic with this monster in this case.
You can't bring up the Gene Hackman scene. I just relive it in my mind. It's maybe one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. Just him shattering his glass and setting him on fire. It is so, the coyote stuff, all that whole sequence, it's just so devastating to see what all of that, because it's just it's a person trying to care, but with kind of an infant's point of view, because he's not mature enough yet mentally to understand all the things that he's doing there. But of course, those are all learning experiences to what he is by the time we see him at the beginning of the movie, then later on at the end when he shows up at the ship fully, we see that those are all learning experiences. The stuff with him and Mia Goth and the connections they have down underneath, like that whole, the connections that they, I mean, she's almost like one of these people that loves nature and loves animals in a way that she cares for him, but then it becomes something much more in their connection, in their spiritual connection, which, you know, ends up leading to her death. And all of that that he carries with him, that is this anger and resentment. It's very simple, but we also see Victor's beginning. And so there's, again, similarities to Sentimental Value. We have what happened to his mom in Sentimental Value affecting Gustav in the present and his relationship with his daughters. And we see that Victor is driven to achieve these things because he had an asshole, domineering, loveless father who whipped him if he didn't remember all the different parts of the body and the different terms for all the medical stuff that's going on. So there's this sense of trying to prove himself to the world because his father destroyed his self-esteem. So the arrogance and the cockiness is covering up this part of him that is has self-confidence issues about what he's doing. You know, it's his act he puts on until he sees that the trauma from his father, he's passed on to the creature. And that is the resolution in a way by the end that I think is powerful from this movie. But yeah, dude, I love this film. I do. I love this. This is my kind of rollicking fucking monster movie that I thoroughly enjoy, you know?
By the way, just on Victor's father, I think Charles Dancy has carved out a niche for himself there, because nobody's better at being that particular kind of a dick, you know? I agree with all those points. And I kind of feel like with this movie that I'm going to watch it again at some point. Mm. And I'm sure I will appreciate more. I just was so turned off by Victor, you know, because it just continues. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it this? Like, you know, and the other thing, I think, by the way, I'm fascinated, and maybe this will be a weird thing to bring up, of, because it doesn't exist like in the original Frankenstein movie, this doesn't exist. But in the book, and obviously in this movie, is the ship frozen in the ice.
Yeah.
Like this, it's so bizarre that that's actually where all of the story of Frankenstein is told. And I find that just one of those fascinating settings, novelistic settings. And the way they handled it and handled way Del Toro created the characters of the captain and what was going on in the ship and the absolutely terrifying nature of this creature.
When
he's coming at you, it is terrifying.
Yeah. When he is moving the ship by himself, Jesus, Mary, Mother of God. And then when he gets onto the bridge of the ship and he's like throwing them all around and you're right, dude. It's a ferocity that's truly unsettling when you see it happening, for sure. What about the cinematography here by Dan Lauston? He was nominated for the cinematography. Do you like the look of it? And even the music by Alexander Desplat, who's a fantastic film composer working now. I think he also did Shape of Water. So what are your thoughts on the cinematography and the music?
Both great. And the cinematography and production design, costume design, makeup and hair, they're all in lockstep, because you can't get this great look if the cinematographer doesn't understand every single color and every single paint treatment that is going on to the set, and the people making the costumes and building the sets can't make sure that they're going to look great unless they understand what the cinematographer is going to do. Yeah. And so this is directing, you know, is like coordinating all those departments and creating this. This is without question in my mind, in a year of many beautiful looking movies, this is the most beautiful of the films. I mean, it's just like every shot is a work of art as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's nominated for 9 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor for Elordi, Best Adapted Screenplay for Del Toro. As we said, as I said, Best Cinematographer, Dan Lawson, Best Production Design, Best Costume Design, Best Makeup and Hairstyling, Best Original Score from Alexander Desplat, and Best Sound. So there's a lot here, Steve. So that tells you how much the Academy loved the movie. Do you think it has a shot to win any of these 9 categories?
To me, production design, costume, and makeup and hair, there's a strong bet. For costume design, I just find Ruthie Carter a tough person to beat ever. Yeah. And Sinners is so iconic in its costume look. But I think this has a really good chance for those. It's so hard because you get into, well, best sound, how is it going to do going up against a movie like F1, you know,
which is
such a sound field movie. I love the score, but there are a bunch of other great scores. I think they will come away with a couple of awards, but it's a tough year.
Yeah, I agree. I would say production design, costume design absolutely has a really good shot at winning both of those. Maybe makeup and hairstyling, but I think it could pull an upset in best supporting actor for Jacob Elordi. And you know, there's Sean Penn is great. I think people love Stellan Skarsgård. People love Benicio, but Jacob delivers like an incredible performance as the monster. And I think that could go a long way with the sympathy of the voters who enjoy this young actor coming up who delivers this really moving portrayal of the monster that affects you. He is the heartbeat of the movie.
So
this may be enough to put him over. So I think there could be an upset. I think Sean Penn will still win, but there could be an upset if Jacob Elordi takes this thing. I would not be surprised if he does, you know, honestly.
It's very possible, and I won't make any predictions, but don't count out Delroy Lindo.
I mean, right, yes, for Sinners, yes, 100%.
I mean, this to me is the toughest actor category, I think. You know, like these are some real, you know, and I would be thrilled if Jacob Elordi won. I would be totally not surprised if Sean Penn won, and I would be over the moon thrilled if Delroy Lindo won.
Yeah. Well, that's our thoughts on Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. We hope you enjoyed this conversation we had on Train Dreams, Sentimental Value, and Frankenstein. We'll be back with our last 4 films here. Speaking of Sinners will be in that mix, one battle after another, The Secret Agent and Begonia. That's how we're going to wrap up our series. And of course, don't forget, we have our Cinephiles Awards there on Saturday, this Saturday at 3 p.m. PT. The ballots are out for you all to vote on them. They're on the free tier of the Patreon. What else do we have to say about this, Steve, that I might have missed here?
Well, it's patreon.com/thecinephiles, and it costs you nothing to vote. You just have to go join the free tier, and you can go to the ballot there. We would prefer, I mean, my feeling is this is all the honor system, but yeah. I am not voting on any category where I have not seen all the things in that category. And there are a couple of those this year. I'm still trying to get through some more films, so maybe I'll be able to vote in more, but that's our feeling, but that's totally up to you. And look, if you want to go vote for who you think should win Best Picture, maybe you want to tell your friends, maybe they want to vote. Maybe you want to create an Oscar campaign or a Cinephiles Award campaign on your own. No reason not to do it, because this year, for the first time ever, we will be doing a Cinephiles deep dive on the winner of our Best Picture Award. So your chance to choose what movie we're going to do is by voting in the Cinephiles Award show. So check it out at patreon.com/thecinephiles.
And do we have an end day, end time for them to where the voting will, you have to cut off the voting so we can calculate the numbers?
I believe in order to have PricewaterhouseCooper and all of them do the full tabulation and have it have it legally verified, we do need a full 24 hours in advance. So voting will close the day before.
Yeah. So Friday on the 13th, 12th. Voting will close.
Or 13th, yeah.
Yes. And then we do our show Saturday the 14th at 3 p.m. PT. And for my fellow cinephile, Steve Morris, I am John Rocha here. Thank you so much for listening to this installment in our 2026 Best Picture Oscar series. And we'll be back with the last 4 films down the road this week.